very unhappy with this recent two state court decisions which allow doctor-assisted suicide. That is regarded not as a crime, but for a doctor to prescribe and help a patient to decide to commit suicide. This is certainly contrary to the Jewish law. That is, we don't believe that we have the right to take our own lives. We don't believe that the right of privacy, as the courts suggest, mean that I'm bleep and utter master of my own life, and therefore I have the right to terminate it whenever I feel that I have sufficient reasons for doing so. But, of course, these court decisions, I guess, will eventually percolate up to the Supreme Court, and we will see what will happen. I don't know what can happen. In any event, I don't want to go into the issue of direct suicide, right? We've studied that. The difficulty, of course, with this decision is that first you have the doctor allow this patient to commit suicide when the patient explicitly says so, and then if it's a patient who is incompetent, you have the doctor or somebody deciding if that's what he really wanted, but he just can't say it, and then the next stage is that you have the society saying that's what he should have wanted, even though he didn't. He said the opposite. So when one is dealing with a typical slippery slope situation where the remedy that's being proposed by the courts to what is a very, very serious problem is probably more harmful than the disease. Tonight we'll see various instances where policy decisions, sometimes taken in the best of interests, have disastrous consequences, unpredicted or at least completely not understood by the decisions as they were then taken. So that I believe that this particular issue of suicide or doctor or assisted suicide is a bad decision. But it's a bad decision in response to a real problem, namely the intrusion of modern technology into what the end of life is all about. It used to be a time that most people, let's say up to 50 or 60 years ago, most people died at home. They died within the framework of their own family, and the doctor, more often than not, viewed his role as one of comforting the family in the face of inevitable death. With the advent of all kinds of modern medicine and modern technology, the role of the doctor has changed completely. The doctor sort of, in the main, regards himself, or up until recently, what's going to happen now with the transition with HMOs and things like that is not clear, but the doctor himself, he regards himself, his primary duty is to fight disease, and maybe even to find disease scientifically, and therefore, one has a problem. Most people today die outside of the home, I would say. I don't know what the figures are as of this moment, but as of 4 or 5 years ago, I think the figures were something like 70 or 80% of the people died either in a hospital setting or in a terminal care facility, but not in the presence of their family. And the general mode was to try to see if one could prevent death, whatever death was, as long as possible, fight disease, and this, of course, had very terrible consequences. So the court, I think, made a bad decision, but I think that this bad decision is in response to a real problem, and what I would like to do is maybe spend tonight and next week, or time, however many more shiurim we're going to actually have, trying to come to grips with this question. It's a new question, right? It's something which, in some sense, prior to 1960, I'm going to call on Jules for medical support in all of these issues, but I think what CPR started around 1960. So that many of these high-tech, intensive emergency measures of saving life and prolonging life is something which is certainly not more than 35 or 40 years old. Yeah, It's true that you had mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. That's not new. But very specific, limited to very specific. You didn't, I think, perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to every patient. You performed a person who was drowning. I think it was something that was almost entirely limited to a situation where the breathing had stopped on account of drowning or something sudden like that. But the notion that when someone's heart has stopped beating, if you just come in and give it a knock from the outside and get it going again and then prolong life, that certainly not more than 35 or 40 years old. I don't know. Did it exist when you studied medicine or had just started?
The medicine they evolved with the zoo and taking through, you were still hoping to get to survive the open chest. So, it's rather brutal. When it does that,
That problem is also probably quite new.
That was new
at that particular point. All right. One thing that CPR has certainly done is that it has changed the definition of death. I think that here's a very clear illustration of where change in scientific technology, not so much a scientific understanding, I don't think there was really any deeper understanding of the science involved before or after CPR. It was just that they realized that you could actually do this effectively. But it does mean that what constitutes being dead certainly has a different definition. If you remember, this was something which was quite a crisis in the 60s and 70s, I would say, or even up until the mid-80s, not only in Jewish law. In other words, there was a crisis at the end of the 18th century when there was a general romantic fear of being buried alive. I'm just reminding you a little bit of prehistory of the subject. All of these tales eventually in Edgar Allan Poe, but he was quite late on the scene. But in the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, one of the horrors were that you appeared to be dead and you really weren't dead and you were buried alive. And therefore the state instituted various laws which required the body to actually become cold or even begin to putrefy before you would actually bury it. This was contrary to Jewish law, which requires immediate burial after death. And in fact, Moses Mendelssohn got involved in this controversy. On the one hand, directing himself to the authorities, he tried to justify the Jewish practice of burial immediately on the same day as death. But then turning inward to the Jewish leaders, in particular writing a letter to Rabbi Yaakov Emden, he tried to argue that perhaps one should not be so fast. And then we learned many times and many years ago a famous tshuva of the Chatam Sofer, in which he analyzes this discussion between Moses Mendelssohn and Rabbi Yaakov Emden and others. And the Chatam Sofer comes quite down quite clearly that there are established halachic criteria of what constitutes death, and they are essentially cessation of breathing. And more or less, this is what it was in all 48 states. I guess at the time that these things were happening, there still were 48 states in the 50s and 60s. And it was only with the institution of things like CPR and other and open heart surgery and various other things where you could see that the heart really stops functioning for a substantial amount of time and its duties being taken over by some artificial mechanism, maybe a temporary pump or something else, that one could not define death to be the stopping of the respiratory, the cardiac or the respiratory system.
When you were in CPR, you had a professor of CPR. You mean artificial life support?
No. I'll get to artificial life support later. I'm just talking about coming in with a massage from the outside or hitting it with an electric shock or something, getting the heart going again after it stopped. I mean exactly that. We'll get to the issues of various forms of artificial life support later. I first want to deal with a problem which is perhaps ideologically difficult, but I don't think that it's either technically or philosophically difficult, and that is that we have to simply, on the basis of modern technology, no longer accept the traditional Khatam Sofer's definition of death as cessation of breathing, and more or less, here's one rare situation where Rabbi Tendler and I agree, take the definition of the cessation of brainstem function, which is accepted in some but not all states as the appropriate definition of what death is. There's a philosophical discussion, you know, what's that Woody Allen movie where they have the nose of the dictator? Sleeper, where certainly one can maintain life in individual cells and even in individual organs after the organism as a whole no longer functions as a whole. For example, after brainstem death, you can still keep the heart going for maybe as long as a week in adults or as long as 2 weeks in children. I think that's the record there. So that therefore, it's conceivable that the heart is still beating because it's kept going artificially, and yet the patient should be, in my view, declared actually dead. On the other hand,
because the example of that the heiress or something.
Let's make a very big distinction. This is very important. We want to make a major distinction between the cessation of brain stem function and cessation of higher cortical function. In other words, you can be in a coma and you can be unconscious, but yet all of the organizational parts of your body, you're still able to breathe, your pupils will dilate or contract in response to light, there'll be certain reflex actions, the heart will keep going. In other words, all higher brain functions may be completely destroyed, yet you're able to, that person is going to be alive according to this definition. But on the other hand, if the stem of the brain, if the whole brain is just not working, then the heart can't keep going without being kept going artificially. And of course, some of the cells of the body might still be alive. In some remote time, you might be able to actually reclone the entire individual from one individual cell, like in the Woody Allen movie. But it seems to me that it's generally accepted, I think, certainly amongst doctors and probably amongst half the state legislatures by now, that that patient should be considered as dead. The thing that you're talking about, which is called persistent vegetative state, PVS, is a very, very complicated problem, and it's one that we're going to have to deal with in the course of the next few shiurim. But the issue is, so I'm not talking about a person who is no longer conscious or has lost consciousness or has become an idiot or has ceased to function as a normal human being. That person is still alive, just as a person who's born as an idiot is alive as a person. But I'm saying that we can accept that if the stem of the brain is no longer functioning, that person should be declared dead. So this is a halachic change, and I think it's a change that's taking place gradually, I think, in all legal systems. There's still some states, for example, which still have two definitions of death. One definition when you want to do a heart transplant and get the guy's heart, and the other older definition that the heart is stopped beating, if that's not what it is. But you can't, philosophically, legally, or anyway, have two definitions of what the word dead means, and on the other hand, you can't operate without such a definition. And there's a quite good book which argues this case quite strongly, and in fact quotes one of the committees on which Tendler is on for dealing with that. So although there's much halachic ideological opposition to this, for example, in one of the things that I've handed out, if you remember on the early days of the heart transplant, when Moshe decided that this was illegal according to Jewish law, because you're killing two people. You're killing the person whose heart you're taking, you're killing the person whose heart you're replacing, and therefore the doctors who were involved in heart transplant surgery were double murderers, according to Moshe. And he never really changed his mind on that issue. The bulk of the handout today are his last writings when he was quite old, just before he was nifta, on various issues of medical thought. But you can see that he's softening on that. There was a big dispute between Rabbi Pendler and the Rosh Lakish Zalman Auerbach on this issue of the definition of death. But I think that we can take it as a necessity that the halacha, along with all the other legal systems, will have to move to the definition of death, meaning the permanent cessation of function of the brain stem. And that matters. It matters whether you can then take the man's heart out for a heart transplant. It matters if you can no longer be machal Shabbos to deal with such a person because he's dead. It matters on issues of inheritance because frequently that hinges on who dies first, and therefore determining what the instant of death is important. So what I'm saying is we should accept that there is a notion of a precise, more or less, nothing in this world is precise, but more or less precise moment of death, and not accept the position that death is some gradual process until the whole body deteriorates, but we have to also accept that there's been a shift from the traditional viewpoint that death occurs when breathing has permanently stopped to the, or unassisted breathing has permanently stopped, to the viewpoint that death occurs when the stem of the brain, as opposed to just the higher functions of the brain, is no longer functioning on a permanent basis. And most of the actual critical ways, I would assume, are not necessarily using EKGs or you know, electronically determining whether brain stem function has ceased, because those are not too reliable. Normally, reflex that modes of determining whether this one
is correct. Even as a layman, I don't know, but doesn't that happen simultaneously? The brain stem death, where breathing stops, vice versa?
In the old days, when you had no means of keeping artificial support, if you stopped breathing for any permanent amount of time, your brain would die within, say, 5 minutes. But that's no longer the case.
No way you can't determine one from the other. I don't understand brain stem death. And what does brain stem do actually for the body? Is that control?
That control. The central control.
The central control. The breathing controls.
In other words, if your brain dies, if your brain stem dies, you will not breathe normally. But you can keep the breathing going and the heart going by a machine. For a small amount of time, for something like a week or two.
How long after, without any machine intervention, how long after brain stem death the cessation of breathing occurs?
Well, it would usually occur first. The breathing continues, and then you have oxygen to feed the brain stem.
Mm-hmm.
So this will only occur afterwards if the patient's already non-lethal.
But I mean, if you destroyed the brain traumatically, then the breathing would stop almost instantaneously. So the death of the brainstem would certainly cause breathing to stop unless you maintained it by some artificial means. And the point is, you can't keep on maintaining the heartbeat by any by artificial means for longer than something like 10 or 20, you know, by a week or two, depending upon whether it's a child or an adult. But you can lose higher mental functions. You can be in this persistent vegetative state indefinitely. The world's record, I think, was some woman who was operated on in 1941 and died in something like 1978. So she lived for 37 years or something in this state of permanent coma, in this comatose state. Okay. So I'm trying to make a clear, simple, elementary, but controversial point, which is that we need something which is a definition of the moment of death. The traditional halacha and most state laws took as the moment of death cessation of breathing. We now have to change that and say that cessation of breathing under normal circumstances would cause death within 4 or 5 minutes, but it's not in and of itself the definition of death. The definition of death is cessation of brainstem function. Okay? It's not a hard problem, except that it's just not agreed. Now I want to come to what is a hard problem, and here I'm just going to need all the help that I can get from everybody in discussing it, because it's a new problem as well, but it's a new problem with so many intricate overtones that it's just hard to know how to come to grips with it, and that is the issue of how to die, when to make the decision to discontinue treatment, who makes the decision, what are the reasons for making these decisions, and how do we deal with that. So I think the way we will work this is that let's first go through, this is a new problem in the dimensions that we have it today. It's something which is a result of medical technology in the last 20 or 5 or 30 years, but it has some philosophical and historical and logical connections going back to ancient times. So let's go through the rather small amount of traditional material. I'm omitting one or two things that basically we can cover in the next 25 or 30 minutes, all of the classical halakhic material on this subject. And then I'll try to turn to what I regard as some of the beginnings of what the issues are by looking at some cases. All right, so let's start with the Gemara and Ketubot. So the first thing that we have to I have two kinds of handouts, one that I can run on my own printer, which doesn't cost me anything, and the other staple thing, which is on from the Xerox machine. So let's first go through these loose pages, which I'm running off on my own printer upstairs. Okay? So the first issue is that it is, even though active suicide is certainly not allowed according to Jewish law, on the other hand, it is not true that we believe that life should be prolonged at all costs and under all circumstances when it is a causing hardship and pain to the patient. So let's read some of the classical cases. The first one has to famous, all of these are famous stories, you've undoubtedly seen them all before, but let's review them. This first one I'm taking somewhere in the middle, which has to do with the death of Rebbe, the death of Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi. So, Amar Lahen, Lehni HaKatana Nitzarech, I'm starting in the middle of the story, because this is talk, it starts about a half a page up in the Masechet Ketubot. And he says, I want to, this is Rebbe talking on his deathbed. Amar Lahen, Lehni HaKatana Nitzarech, Nechnas Rebbe Shimon Eilav. Masar lo sidrei chachma. He gave them various rules or regulations of study. Amar lehem levni gadol ani tzarech. Nechnas avin yamliya letzlo masar lo sidrei nesiyut. He gave him last minute deathbed instructions on how to run the government. Amar lo bni nahog nesiyut chavar anim zvok marav ha-talmidim. Deal with distinguished people in your presidency, and also put a little fear into the students. Be a little bit, be a disciplinarian. Eini v'hachtir v'et yirei Hashem yichabei, v'yamar mar zei ha-shapat melech yudha k'shayer o'et ha-mit chacham ha-ya o'nei m'kiso m'chakko m'nashko. You should show love and mercy to tamidei chachamim rather than putting the fear of God into them. V'kore lo rebi rebi mori mori lo kashya ho b'tzino ho b'fabesu. Publicly, you should show respect that sometimes discipline is necessary in the school system. Tanya, Rebbe mutal b'tzipori, u'makom muhan lo b'beit shari. Rebbe's sickbed was in Tzipori, with his permanent place of rest, his burial place being in Beit Shari. I was in Tzipori this summer. Have you ever been? Have you been to Tzipori lately? They've done marvelous, marvelous archaeological excavations. I don't know. We were there this winter. Tzipori is in the Galil. It's absolutely beautiful. They have these really very rich, fancy Roman houses with unbelievable mosaics on the floor, which they've excavated, and they've turned it into an absolutely beautiful park. And what Aviva and I found most touching is that, you know, you see these people working there, moving the rocks and doing all of the construction work, and you expect to hear them talking Arabic, because that's what you're used to, and they're all talking Russian. So it's well, it's beautiful. If you're ever in Israel and you have a chance to go up to the Galil, I recommend it. But in any event, then I'm just simply saying it's nice. Okay. All right.
Tanya Tzedek Tildo Halakha Rebbe Le Beit Sharim, Rebbe Le Beit Sharim Haba. He was in Beit Sharim, Haba Kevan, the Halash, and Tiyuri Litzipori, the Medalia of Basim Adil. He was taken to Litzipori because of the pyre that was high up and the air is better. It really is high up and it's really quite beautiful. Ahu Yuma. The Noch Bashe the Rebbe, on the day of Rebbe's death, Gazur Banan Ta'anita Uboi Rachan. The rabbis all declared a fast day and begged for forgiveness. But only Kol Mande Yamar Noch Bashe the Rebbe Yidkal Becher. We'll spare anybody who says that Rebbe actually died. Salika Amte the Rebbe Le'idra. Rebbe's maidservant went up to the roof to pray. Amra El Yonim Vakshin et Rebbe. The Bezdin Shalmaila is asking for Rebbe to come, and we here below are asking Rebbe. Let the lower court overwhelm the upper court. When she saw that Rebbe was suffering from some intense diarrhea and had to go to the bathroom very often and was in really extreme pain, I pray that the upper court should win over the lower court. Meanwhile, downstairs, outside the building, all the rabbis were praying for Rebbe's survival. She took a jar and threw it down and smashed, made a noise, causing the prayers down below stop. Ishtukul mirachani. So the rabbis downstairs stopped praying for an instant. And Rebbe died. So here is a situation where notice it doesn't say that Rebbe's son, either of his sons or his wife, who were all present, took this action. It was the maidservant. Dr. Schwaber can affirm or deny, but I think in modern times it's very frequently the nurse who has the most direct interaction with the patient that frequently is most aware, even more than the attending physician, of what the patient's true needs are in many of these circumstances. So here is a situation where, in fact, it was Rebbe's maidservant who understood what was best for him and prayed for his death and silenced the prayers of the other rabbis. So a clear lesson from this, the issue about nurses and doctors is not clear from this, but the clear lesson from this is that there are times in which it's permissible or even desirable to pray for someone's death and even to prevent others from praying for his survival.
Is there a cause and effect because of the smashing of the, like you have in that other case?
We'll come to that. Yeah. I'll go over here. That's the Shulchan Adibovim. We'll come to that. Okay. All right. Let's turn to the Gemara and Dari. My next page. Rav Chelbo Chalash. Rav Chelbo took ill. Nafak Achriz Rav Kahana. Rav Chelbo Boich. Rav Chelbo Kahana went out and proclaimed that Rav Chelbo is not feeling well. Lo ika the ka'ati. No one actually came to pay a sick call. He was just allowed to lie in the sick room without any visitors. Amalu. So he got angry at the contact at the students, why they didn't go and actually be mbaker cholim. Lo kachaya ma'ase. Wasn't there a case, but Talmid echad mi talmidei Rabbi Akiva shechala. That there was a student of Rabbi Akiva who became ill, and the other rabbis, the scholars, didn't go to pay him a sick call. Rabbi Akiva went in to visit him. So when they saw that such a distinguished man as Rabbi Akiva came into the room, they paid attention and cleaned up the room and gave him some better service, and in fact he recovered. Amale Rebbe Hechi Itani. The student said to Rabbi Akiva, Rebbe, you saved my life. Yatsa Rabbi Akiva Vadarash.
Kol mi she'ein mevaker cholim ki'ilu shofech damim. Someone who refuses to pay visits to the sick is like committing murder. Ki yasa rabdimi amar kol mevaker es ha'chole gorom lo she'im ki'ay. For kol she'ein o mevaker et ha'chole gorom lo she'im yamot. My grandma, Ilema kol ha'mevaker et ha'chole mevakesh alar v'achamim she'yifia v'kol she'ein o mevaker et ha'chole mevakesh alar v'achamim she'yamot, she'yamot sakadaita. Ella kol she'ein mevaker chole, ein mevakesh alav rachamim, lo she'yichye v'lo she'yamot. You don't visit the sick person, then you're not going to pray either for his survival or for his demise. So the implication to be drawn from here is that sometimes we pray for the patient to die rather than to survive, and that's exactly what the Ran, I reproduced the Ran on the bottom of the page. Ein v'bakesh alav rachamim lo she'yichye v'lo she'yamot. Nira ve'enai v'hachi ki amar. This is what it means. Pa'amim she'tzarich l'bakesh harachamim al ha'chole she'yamot. Sometimes we have to pray that a patient die. Kegon she'mitzta'er ha'chole v'choliyot harbei v'i efshar lo she'yichye. When the patient is in a great deal of pain and it's impossible for him to have any chance for long-term survival, that's the one that we just studied. The cave in the Chazal, Yam Teh Rebbe, the Alchal Daol Kamizima Levet Kisei V'Anach Tfilin V'Kam Mitztayer Amor Yehi Ratzon She'yachofu Elyonim Et HaTachtonim Klomar L'Limot Rebbe U'Mishem Hachi Ka'amar D'Hamavaker Choleh even if there would be some benefit for the patient that the person would pray for his death, so if you refrain from getting involved with the patient, you can't even pray that he die to lead the patient to suffer. So here the Ran is quite clear that it's permissible, and in fact, less than only permissible, but desirable to pray for a person's death. And on this basis, as we will see a bit later, with Moshe, for example, says that a patient has the right, if he is in pain and suffering, to decline medication or treatment, which will do nothing but simply prolong his life for a finite period of time, a Elijah thing. And I mean, that's our practical problem today. We have an enormous difficulty in how to deal with it, but at least we see that philosophically it is not always true that it's better to keep on living than dying.
And they're still not pulling the plug. It's like letting it, leave you alone and let the blood be.
No, you're praying for his death.
And how about the person, the patient himself? You know, he's not praying either way.
Well, he was in pain. He didn't know what was best for him. Rebbe was just suffering. That's the typical case. Unfortunately, the typical case, again, I'm going to defer to Dr. Schwaber, but the typical case in these terminal cases is that the patient is either in such distress or is incompetent or that it's very hard for him to know what's best for him.
The patient is unable to communicate it to her through feelings, even if it's closer to medicating.
And on the other hand, he may be in intense pain for an illness which will pass. I mean, sometimes when a person is in an intense amount of pain, he just wants to die because he just can't bear the pain, and 3 hours later he may recover completely. So it's not always so easy to say that the patient knows best. Certainly the patient has to decide, but that's frequently impossible.
Right. Rabbi, in this case, we have an outside person who's praying. Right? Mm-hmm. So is there any implication there that another person besides the one that's sick has some kind of a right to make a decision? Because you pray to Hashem, in that case...
The implication here is
helping you make a decision.
With the implication from the story of Rebbe, which is clearer, is that somehow or other she knew better because she was dealing with him, she was nursing him, she was taking care of him. She knew better than all the rabbis, you know, who were standing outside the door praying for his continued life.
So what? How long?
What is it?
The minimal halakha that we can learn from this is that if the patient is competent, and if the patient decides, and if the patient is aware of the fact that this is a terminal illness, and the patient does not want to prolong this terminal illness because the pain and the suffering or the eventual incompetence is too unbearable for him, he has the right to refuse medication. That's the minimal thing that we can learn from this. The next step becomes more complicated. The next step becomes whether his family can decide, whether the nurse can decide, how do we decide, how do we know what the patient would have said or really wants. Those are the things that Dr. Schwaber mentioned. And these are enormously complicated questions. But the first question that you have to get clear in your own mind is that it's not always true that we should fight for the survival of the patient. That's the minimal thing that we can learn from this story. Okay? I mean, this is not an easy problem, and it's become enormously complicated, as I will try to begin to explain, because of some events that have occurred in the last 20, 25 years, both in medicine and in the United States Congress. What has happened is so complicated that we have to just be able to take apart these things, but we have to at least have some fundamental guiding principles before we can even begin. Whether we can actually implement these principles in practice will be complicated, but you can't avoid the question. I'm saying that this is a much more complicated question than the one that we've dealt with before, which was controversial but simple, namely deciding what the moment of death is.
If there's no problem with the patient refusing medicine, that doesn't border on suicide?
If everything borders on suicide, the question is how you draw the line. And what with Moshe, for example, in a tshuva that we may not get to this evening, but is in the packet that I cast out, and we may get to it next week, we read it, says that indeed a patient in a terminal illness who's suffering from pain has the right to refuse further treatment and be allowed to die naturally.
So he, in essence, is pulling the switch or whatever?
I think we should come to this. We'll come to this slowly. But since you brought it up, let's just analyze this. In a moment, Mr. Weinstein will remind us that we study the Shultei HaGibori, who discusses, after we're finished with the Gemara, who says that there's a difference, and this is not only in halacha, but has been in the past in medicine as well, and it's also something intuitive, is that there's a difference between active intervention and passive intervention. Not, as you say, not turning off the switch is, in some intuitive sense, a lot harder to do than not turning the switch on in the first place. But this no longer really makes any sense today. The difference between active and passive, which may have been clear-cut 25 or 30 years ago, is no longer clear-cut today, because everybody's on some kind of a switch or another. And furthermore, there's a danger in imposing this policy, because imagine that you're going to decide that you can never turn off the switch. Suppose you've taken that as your general rule. No matter what type of major intervention you're going to make, you're never going to turn off the switch. Then you may very well be reluctant to turn on the switch in the first place to a patient who may very well recover. In other words, having a rule which says that once the switch is on, you can't turn it off, really prevents you from engaging in massive intervention where it's truly justified. So therefore, all of these old rules, which had very good reasons behind them, the difference between active and passive is because of a slippery slope phenomenon. You want to avoid suicide. And or killing or euthanasia. You want to get away from all of that, and therefore, in the old days, it was very easy to draw a line between what was active and what was passive. But in, and we'll get to a very complicated question of what is active and what is passive in this very next passage in the Gemara that we will study. But nowadays, even the notion of imposing that rule has with it a whole slew of dangers. Because the slippery slope is frequently on the other side. You're never going to actively intervene if you're worried that you'll never be able to terminate. So easily formulated rules which existed 50 years ago are no longer either good or easily applicable today, and that's the problem that we have. Okay, here's a story which is even more famous than the ones that we've studied so far. Okay? Tanu Rabbanan. Kishakhala Rabbi Yossi Bal Kisma. When Rabbi Yossi Bal Kisma was ill, Halach Rabbi Chanina ben Targion Lebakbo. Rabbi Chanina ben Targion went to visit. Amar lo Chanina Achi. Rabbi Yossi Bal Kisma, who was ill, said to Rabbi Chanina ben Targion, Chanina, my brother, Iyata Yodea Shabumo Zonun Hashamayim Mikua. Don't you know that the Roman government has been imposed on us by God? Shech Riva et Beitou. The Zalfai paper low, it destroyed the temple. Bahagua Chasidav, he died to Bav. Ba'adayin he kayemet. He did all of these terrible things to the Jews, and yet the Roman Empire is still surviving. Ba'ani shamati alecha sh'ata yoshev yosef b'torah u'makil kilot v'rabim. V'seita munach l'cha b'chekecha. And I've heard that you're teaching Torah publicly, even though this is against the law. How can you do such a thing when you know that the Roman government has prohibited it and they are in firm control? Amar lo ben ha-shamayim racham. Rabbi Chanina ben Taradion said to him, heaven will take care. Amar lo, ani omer lacha devarim shel tam, v'yata omer li min ha-shamayim rachamu. I'm trying to talk to you logically and you're telling me that God will provide. What kind of an answer is that? Tama ani, I would be surprised if you and together with the Sefer Torah will not be burned. Amarlo, Rebbe, ma'ani l'chayeh olam abla. What chance do I have of coming to the world to come? Amarlo, kluma aseba yiracha. Amarlo, ma'ot shapurim lecha, pali bimahot shazdaka, v'tilakem ma'aniyim. Amar lecha, imkein, michalkecha, yilchalki, migorolcha, yirgolim. Amar, amru. So that was the end of this portentous sick room visit. Amru lo hayu yamim uatim ad sheniftar Rabbi Yossi bar Kisma valku kol gedolei Romi lekovro. And all of the Roman authorities went to the burial. Veskidu hasbei gedol. Umchazvatan matzu lo Rabbi Chanina ben Targion shehaya yoshev yosef b'torah umakil kilot rabim b'seik ha-torah munach lo b'chalko. They took him to the stake and wrapped him around with the Sefer Torah. They kipu v'chavleiz mugot. They hitzitu b'hem et ha'u. They wrapped him in rope and set the ropes on fire. They hiviu sfugin shel semer v'shavun b'mayim v'hiku al libo k'dei shelo teitzei nishmato mehera. And they kept wet wool on his heart to keep him alive longer so that he would be tortured and be in pain, so that he would die a slow and painful death. Amulo bito abba erachabachach. How can I see you like that? The daughter said, Amarla, Amarla, ilmale ani nisrafti levadi haya davar kashel. Achshav shani nisraf v'sefer Torah eli, mi shemavakesh elgona shel sefer Torah hu yivakesh elgona. Whoever will seek the justice for the destruction of the Sefer Torah will also seek the justice for my death. Amulal Talmidav Rebbe Ma'ato Ra'eh, what do you see? Amar lahen gilyon nisrofin v'yotori kolchot. The sheets are burned, but the letters are flying off. Atap tachpicha v'tiyenes ba'esh, why don't you open your mouth and breathe in the fire so that therefore you will die. Amar lahen mutav sheni yitmena mishen natna ba'al yichabel hu ba'atzma. That God who gave me life, take it away, I will refuse to actively bring about a faster death. Amar lo chetzpunuri, the torturer said to him, Rebbe, im ani marbe b'shal hebet unotel tzvugin shal tzema me'al b'kha atam v'yeni l'chaye olam haba. If I raise up the fire and take away the wool, worldwide have a share in the world to come. Amar lo hein, Ishavali, swear to me, nishbalo. Miyad yerbeva shal hebet v'natal sugin shal sema me'al libo, yatsa nishmato b'mahira. Yaku kafatz v'napal otol cha'ur, yatsa l'vat kol v'yamor rabi chanina v'entradion v'kal tzenui muzmanim l'chaye olam haba. Bachar Rebbe v'yamar, yesh kone olama v'sha'achat,
V'yesh koneh olamo b'kama shanim. This is certainly one of the most famous stories there is. But of course, what is the difference between opening your mouth and having the executioner remove the wet wool so that you can die faster? What's the difference?
Because he opened it, he did it. The other way, somebody else did it.
So you're saying that the difference is that that you can tell a guy to kill you or to kill, but you can't do it yourself.
I'd say in a way, that's what this seems to imply.
I don't know what the story implies, to be the honest truth. I think the most sensible implication...
He didn't ask him. It was the executioner suggested it.
Right. So he didn't ask. So if you don't ask him...
He's a typical doctor.
I don't know about that. I think the doctor...
He's suggesting maybe you ought not to take any more medicine, and that's the end you're in.
Yeah, so no, it's not clear. I would tend to believe that the story is, again, just this difference between active and passive, but somehow or other removing the wet rags, of course it doesn't apply to raising the fire, but removing the wet rags might be considered as removing an obstacle to a quick death rather than an active one.